your need-to-know cultural snapshot of Wisconsin and beyond. This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max, sponsored by Visit Milwaukee, a deep dive into all things intriguing, riveting, and entertaining. Now, here's your host, Sandy Max.
What's on Tap is sponsored by Visit Milwaukee, handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org. One of those nights, huh? Sandy's taking a well-deserved vacation, but she wanted me, I'm Libby Collins, to remind you that she'll be co-hosting that red carpet for Skylight Music Theater's Tony Awards Watch Party on Sunday, June 7th, and she's going to have more details when she returns to What's on Tap next week. Now, I'm going to tell you this here at the top of the show, because if you are not already watching us on YouTube or at WTMJ.com on our stream, you'll want to sign in now, because you're not going to want to miss some of the artwork we're talking about tonight during the show, including some movie posters like nothing you've ever seen before. Also, we are having a great ticket giveaway tonight for one lucky winner. Who's it for? How about the Tom Jones One Last Ride Tour to the Miller High Life Theater? It's happening on September 20th, and one lucky winner is going to get those two tickets. So stick around for that giveaway. Also, are you a fan of Dr. Seuss? Well, like most of us, he's been a part of our life as long as we can remember. And this week, there's an exhibit of Dr. Seuss art coming to Whitefish Bay. And we're going to hear about that, and we're also going to explore the wit and wisdom of the creator of Dr. Seuss. Matt Miller's going to stop by with his take on some summer blockbuster movies. We're going to be discussing a collaboration between the Milwaukee Art Museum and Present Music. Wait until you hear that. We've got Matt Yazel here. He's pushing those buttons. Jessica Gatzo is in the newsroom. And coming up in just a minute, we're going to tell you about one of the most unusual movie poster exhibits to ever be in Milwaukee. And it's only going to be here for a few days because it's a pop-up. Now, if you're watching us on YouTube or at WTMJ.com, I promise you, after seeing some of these posters, you'll never watch the movies the same again. That's all coming up on What's on Tap right here on WTMJ. It's 60 degrees at 6:11. And welcome back. I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy Max. Something, and I have to say, my mind is blown. And this is one of them, because I got an email yesterday from the Charles Alice Art Museum saying that they have a pop-up exhibition at Charles Alice Art Museum starting on Sunday, but it's called something interesting, Deadly Prey. But what's in this exhibit is what is really blowing my mind. And joining us to talk about it is Grace Dugan. And Grace, first of all, congratulations on this pop-up. Now, tell us where this came from.
Thank you. Yeah, so Deadly Prey is a gallery based out of Chicago that works with about 10 different artists living and working in the Ghana area in Africa. They do a tour where they tour lots of different states and cities, and they were looking for somewhere to host in the Midwest. And we thought that the Charles Alice Art Museum is a really great venue. So we reached out to them and, yeah, agreed that it would be a really great place to showcase this work. The Alice is actually the largest venue that Deadly Prey has exhibited with. So we're really, really excited to offer that to Milwaukee.
What is interesting is the artwork itself. Now, you said that the artists are all based in Ghana, Africa. And yeah, these are all movie, television, pop art kind of posters. And just about every movie I can ever think of is somehow in one of these posters. But it's not like the way that we would normally think of these movies. I'm looking at one right now, a picture of one from Pulp Fiction, where, of course, they have the John Travolta and the Uma Thurman character, and they have Samuel L. Jackson. But then they have a giant mushroom cloud in the background with cobras and skeletons. And I don't know, I kind of missed that when I saw Pulp Fiction the first time.
Yeah. The style of these posters is, you know, they're sort of zany, they're sort of out there, sort of goofy, but they use, like you said, those characters from the movies or shows and just sort of the storylines, but each artist has their own individual style. But yeah, the style of these movie posters is really not something that you're going to get at just another bookstore or movie store. They're really, really interesting and unique.
How many of these posters are you going to be exhibiting?
Hundreds. We have a really, really large inventory. Yeah, thanks to Deadly Prey. Again, they're a traveling exhibition. So I think they're in Minneapolis the week before. But yeah, we have a very, very large selection, and also t-shirts, bags, other sorts of merchandise with these designs on them as well.
But I mean, every movie I can ever think of is represented. You've got Star Wars, The Shining, The Matrix, Mrs. Doubtfire, Oppenheimer, The Terminator, Dumb and Dumber. I mean, the selection of movies. I had no idea they had that many movies theaters in Ghana, Africa.
Yep, there is truly something for everyone at this one.
Have you talked to any of the artists?
I have not personally talked to them, no, but they do have some brief profiles on Deadly Prey's website, just detailing the artists and their lives and their style.
Do they go for a sense of humor? It's not the traditional movie poster that we have here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of the artists are kind of going for that aspect of humor in their work and just sort of out there, different than what you would get with another sort of movie poster. So it's really exciting.
And it's not all movie posters. I mean, I saw some for TV shows like Better Call Saul, The Bear, even Twin Peaks. It's a wide variety. Whatever genre of movie or television you're interested in, there is a poster with a representation of the characters from that film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, is there anyone in particular that kind of sticks out to you that when you first saw it, you said, wow, who'd have thunk?
I really like the Stand By Me poster that I saw. I think it's just a funny movie to sort of rework in that, you know, silly sort of funny style. But yeah, there are a lot of movies that you might not expect to be included, like you were saying, like Kill Bill and other movies that aren't necessarily like comedy, but that are interpreted in this really interesting way through the posters. So
oh, no.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited to see the collection.
Well, going back even to a classic movie like Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, there's a picture of who I think is maybe, who was the star of that? Was that, I can't remember the actress, but she's standing there holding a decapitated Jimmy Stewart's head, holding a sickle. Now, I missed that scene. I missed that scene in the film.
Yeah. I think the interpretations that the artists do are really quite interesting. And yeah, you might walk in and see some that might shock you a little bit.
Oh, well, shock or make you laugh or make you think.
Yeah.
Now, again, this is a pop-up exhibit at the Charles Ellis Art Museum, and it begins on Sunday, but you've only got it for a few days.
Yeah, so Sunday is our opening, 6 to 10 p.m., and then we will be open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Just regular museum hours, and then they're gone. So just 1 week only.
And you have to see it to believe it. Right now I'm looking at a poster of Free Willy, you know, that really friendly whale that we all wanted to save. But in this particular portrayal, it looks more like a deadly scene out of Jaws. Free Willy is not friendly in this movie. So you have to see it to believe it. And do you need to get tickets in advance, or how do we get in to see the pop-up exhibit of Deadly Prey?
Yeah, so we have an RSVP on our website, totally optional. It is free and open to the public. So just come on over to the Charles Ellis Art Museum. We're at 1801 North Prospect Avenue, which is just a block north of Brady Street on the east side of Milwaukee.
I think you have outdone yourselves with this one. Going to a Victorian mansion to see these particular pieces of art, it's going to be a head-turning experience, to say the least.
Truly, you might find some posters that have some head-turning images on them as well.
Literally. Grace Dugan from the Charles Ellis Art Museum, thank you so much for joining us on What's on Tap.
Yeah, thank you.
As I said before, you will never watch those movies the same way after you see some of these posters. It's 6:20. Coming up next, we've got a little bit more conventional art and also music that accompanies it. It's a collaboration between the Milwaukee Art Museum and Present Music, and you'll hear about it right after this on What's on Tap. Sandy's off tonight. I'm Libby Collins. We're here with you until 8 o'clock this evening, and I am so excited to introduce our next guest. His name is Eric Segnitz. He is the Present Music's Artistic Director, and they're doing something very, very special this year. When there's a collaboration on June 5th with a program between the Milwaukee Art Museum that features Grammy-nominated composer, flautist, and vocalist Natalie Zawasham. And along with that, you are going to hear some amazing music. And Eric, first of all, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So tell us a little bit about Natalie Zawasham. She's been nominated for Grammys?
Yeah, she's a very well-known composer, flutist, and vocalist, and also a professor of composition at Princeton University. So she's very grounded in classical tradition and craft, but she expresses herself in another way.
Has she performed in Milwaukee in the past?
No, I don't believe so.
So this is a first for the city.
Yes.
Now tell us about this collaboration with the Milwaukee Art Museum and why this makes sense. Because I think a lot of people are thinking, music, art, aren't they totally different?
Not in this case. The Milwaukee Art Museum has one of the premier Haitian art collections in the world. And Natalie is Haitian, or of Haitian descent, and her piece we're featuring is all about her sixth-generation lineage in Haiti. And so there's a connection there. And also there's another exhibit at the Art Museum by Woodline Cadet, who is a photographer, and that also has a Haitian connection. She emigrated from Haiti. So there's a big Haitian connection in this program and other tie-ins to the other music.
How did you decide on this collaboration? I mean, were there a lot of discussions beforehand of how can we bring Haitian music to Milwaukee to accompany these exhibits?
Well, we've worked with the museum a lot in the past and with specific curators, this time with a curator named Kantara Souffrant, and she is also Haitian. She had an interest in this artist and an interest in promoting this exhibit. And so we worked together to create this program. But, you know, in our 45-year history, we've been at the Art Museum a lot of that time. Not all of our concerts, but one or two a year.
And what about Haitian music? What makes it stand out from other genres?
Well, the folk elements, the indigenous folk elements of Haiti. It's really, I would say this piece is more about the artist's interpretation and where she finds her identity and sense of place in that tradition. It's a very lush creation, I can tell you that. It's very melodic and rhythmic, a lot of vocal layering. And I think you mentioned her Grammy nomination was actually in a world music category. So if you didn't know that she was a classically trained person, you might mistake it for world music.
And will there be more than just she playing? I mean, is it an ensemble?
Yes. The Present Music Ensemble will play with her and will perform two other pieces that have some similar themes, one by a Brazilian composer and one by a composer with Andean roots. So we're hitting different parts of the world, different ancient civilizations.
All right. As a performer, as a musician, how do you differentiate among those various traditions of music? How would Haitian music compare to something like Andean music?
Well, that's really embedded in the composer's vision. We try and find a way into every piece we're presented, and that's one of the challenges of playing contemporary music. You're presented with something that you've don't know anything about, and you have to find a way into it. And so we have our group is made up of specialists from some of the best groups in the country, and they bring that experience to these programs.
How many musicians are there?
In this program, there are only 8. Sometimes we flex up to 20, depending on the repertoire.
What instruments would you bring in for Haitian music, for performance of Haitian music?
Well, this program has string instruments, wind instruments, percussion instruments, and some electronic instruments, and vocals. One of the other pieces features sort of a spiritual chant from Nigeria. And so there are a lot of different elements.
How would you describe Haitian music? What is it comparable to? Does it compare to anything that people might be more familiar with?
Well, people who listen to shows like The World Cafe will be familiar with these sounds. They've been featured a lot in world music compilations, and you know, it's features a lot of percussion based music, generally not like traditional Western classical orchestral instruments, and so that's a liberty that the composer has taken. But she's a fantastic dynamic flute player, and so you would have to forgive her for that.
Oh, well, we'll hear more about it. We're talking with Eric Segnitz. He is Present Music's Artistic Director, and they are closing their season on June 5th with a very special program at the Milwaukee Art Museum featuring Grammy-nominated composer, flautist, and vocalist Natalie Joachim. I hope I got that right that time. All right, it is 6:30, and speaking of musicians, Jessica Gatso, you're a musician.
Yes, I am.
And you're also a newswoman. So tell us what is going on right now at 6:30. And Sandy will be back next week. I'm Libby Collins, and we're here with you until 8 o'clock tonight. We're talking with Eric Segnitz. He is Present Music's Artistic Director. I'm talking about Present Music. How long have you been around doing this?
I joined the group in its second year as a core violinist. And so I played 40 years of concerts, six concerts a year, and then I became the artistic director when Kevin Stahlheim, who was the founder and built this whole thing, stepped down. And so this is my second career, you might say.
You mentioned for this particular event on June 5th, there's eight musicians, but sometimes you have as many as 20. So are there all the same musicians all the time? Do they come? Do they go? How do you program the various concerts you perform?
Okay, that's a good question. We have an unusual model. All these new music groups have different models. It's not like orchestras who are sort of, I wouldn't say interchangeable, but the model is. We flex according to the repertoire we choose to present. And so we start with a core of six or seven musicians. And then we add and subtract as needed, and we draw musicians from all over the country at this point.
When you're playing with somebody that you haven't played with before, how do you adapt?
Well, that's the beauty of having a core ensemble, because you're never starting from zero. But you're right. It is a certain alchemy of putting personalities together and matching talents to repertoire. A little like a sports team.
Well, that's what I was going to say. When you have someone as well known as a Natalie Joachim, who's been nominated for a Grammy, she's world famous. Mm-hmm. How do you? I mean, is it all intimidating if you've never met that performer before? You might admire their expertise and their artistry, but being in the same room's got to add a little bit of pressure.
Oh, it's true. It can be that way. There is a lot of networking in new music circles, and so our conductor, David Bloom, has worked with Natalie before. Our violinist has worked with her before, so there are connections already. I don't anticipate it'll be very weird.
Before you actually have the performance, I mean, how much practice time do you have with her?
Oh, it's condensed. We put together very complicated programs in a matter of days, because we're flying in people from all over the place.
So is it possible that you haven't all performed together in the same room before you actually get to that core performance?
Well, if you're talking about all of us in total, I'd say that's more the rule than the exception. That's often the case.
So how does that all come together?
People prepare. People bring their expertise. And we often have a conductor, so that helps a lot. David's a wonderful conductor. We have guest conductors, and they you know, manage the rehearsal process.
What do you find most exciting as an artist, to be able to tie in a program like the one you're doing with the Milwaukee Art Museum, and the fact that you've got such a gifted artist from Haiti performing that music, tying mm-hmm. it in with the art from that country?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a special program. In general, we get very excited about presenting Milwaukee with new things. You know, our audiences are very open-minded. They bring a lot of curiosity and a sense of adventure. And if that's the kind of person you are, you're our audience. There's no esoteric knowledge you need to bring to these concerts. You just need an open mind. And
do you recommend, or if somebody asks you ahead of time for something like this, if they're not familiar with Haitian art or Haitian music, do you recommend that they try to learn about it before they come to a performance? Or are you hoping that they want to learn more about it after hearing the music and seeing some of the art?
Well, both. I am, you know, being confronted with something new is an experience, a unique experience. If you want to check out the Haitian art collection before you go, it's all online. You can find the Milwaukee Art Museum's collection online. It is really eye-opening to see it and then hear the music. I'll say that. And you'll hear Natalie talk about the culture and her family history, and she really brings you into the experience. So that's an element of our concerts that is like outside the classical model. We talk to our audience. It's not a formal experience, so to speak.
Well, and so much of what the history of that country is that so many people migrated away, and that's had such an impact on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the really people aren't that familiar with the importance of the country. I believe it was the first black nation that separated itself from colonization in the world. And that's very important.
We are talking with Eric Stignitz. He is with Present Music. He's their artistic director. There's an event happening on June 7th, and we're going to tell you where it is and what you need to know, or on June 5th, rather. We're going to tell you where it's happening and what you need to know before you get there. It's all ahead on What's on Tap on WTMJ. And I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy Max tonight. We're talking with Eric Stignitz. He is Present Music's co-artistic director. Their final show of the season is going to take place on June 5th. And where is it again, Eric?
At the Milwaukee Art Museum in the Calatrava Atrium.
Now, that's an unusual place. Usually people go to a theater, a symphony hall. What's it like, and what are the acoustics like in the atrium at the Calatrava?
Well, it's very live, as you can imagine, but we program for the acoustic, and so it's a wonderful place to take in a concert. People are very excited to go there. It has the feel of an event, I would say. Usually it does.
So if you are interested in going, do you need to get tickets ahead of time?
I would recommend it. You can go to our website, which is presentmusic.org, and click on the event link, and that'll take you to our box office.
And it starts at 7:30, the concert.
Yes.
But you can come early and look at the art.
The art exhibits, the three art exhibits, are open at 5:30. There is a cash bar. It's not a formal thing at all.
And I think a lot of people are wondering, if it's in the atrium, is there a place to sit? Are there going to be chairs there for them?
Many, many chairs, yeah.
So
yeah.
You don't have to stand to hear the concert.
No.
Well, before you go, I really want to find out, next year, mm-hmm. I'm sure you've got plans for your season. Can you give us any hints as to what you might be performing?
I'd be happy to. It's our 45th season, and we'll be releasing the details on the 5th. Subscriptions will be available on the website I just mentioned, as well as details. We'll be doing a mix of some classic new music pieces that have never been played in Milwaukee, great pieces, and a lot of new pieces commissioned, especially for Milwaukee, from women composers next year. We're commissioning five women composers who are some of the most individual compositional voices out there. Very excited about that. We are doing a video opera by Steve Reich, who is entering his 90th year, I believe. A lot of interesting programs, a folk singer, a drama about King George going crazy and talking to his birds. And
that one I think I'd like to see.
Our annual Thanksgiving concert at St. John's Cathedral, which is always a wonderful show. There's a lot going on.
Eric Segnitz, present music I got to get this straight now. Your present music's artistic director. And Eric, thank you so much for being here tonight. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Same here. Thank you.
And I'm Libby Collins. It is 6:47 tonight. We're going to get down to about 50 degrees under clear skies. Tomorrow's pretty nice. We're looking at sunshine. The temperature is going to be about 78 if you're inland, 73 near the lake. And then Saturday, more sun, more warm temperatures in the low 70s. And believe it or not, the same thing for Sunday. We're going to get up to 75 degrees under sunny skies. It's 59 at 6:48 on WTMJ. Well, I told you a little bit earlier that we were going to do this because Tom Jones is bringing his One Last Ride tour to the Miller High Life Theater on September 20th. Now, this tour promises to be a celebration of one of popular music's most enduring voices and personalities. It's set against a rich backdrop of more than 60 years. You know, Tom Jones has delivered unforgettable hits like It's Not Unusual. That fun song. What's New Pussycat? And She's a Lady. Now, if you are caller number 12 on the WTMJ Siding Unlimited talk and text line at 855-616-1620, if you call us right now and you're caller number 12, you will win a pair of tickets to see Tom Jones on September 20th at the Miller High Life Theater. By the way, you don't want to miss this show, because tickets go on sale tomorrow, May 29th at 10 a.m. at PabstTheaterGroup.com. And I have seen Tom Jones in performance, and let me tell you, he puts on a show. It's 6:49 on WTMJ. And I'm Libby Collins. Welcome back to What's on Tap on WTMJ. Congratulations to Jen. She just won those two tickets to see Tom Jones at the One Last Ride Tour at the Miller High Life Theater on September 20th. And remember, those tickets go on sale tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock at PabstTheaterGroup.com.
And now, feast your ears. This is the song you need to hear.
Most blokes are going to be playing at 10. These go to 11.
It is the song you need to hear. Well, we just talked about Tom Jones. So, of course, we've got to go to a Tom Jones song. Which one? How about What's New Pussycat? It was released in 1965. Written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Well, you know them because, boy, they had every popular song in the 60s and 70s you can imagine. And it was written for a Woody Allen-written comedy called, what else? What's New Pussycat? That starred Peter Sellers and Peter O'Toole. You know, the interesting thing about Burt Bacharach is he created the melody after watching Peter Sellers' eccentric character on screen. And he then used Kurt Weill's style chords to capture the film's bizarre and brilliantly weird energy. Hal David then, after all that, wrote all the lyrics, which he intentionally meant to be outrageous. What's New Pussycat reached number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, and that, of course, cemented Tom Jones' reputation as a leading pop artist of the era. And What's New Pussycat became one of his most requested songs. So, of course, here it is, Tom Jones.
Nose.
I love that song. It brings back great memories. Tom Jones, you can see him in person on September 20th at the Miller High Life Theater. And those tickets go on sale tomorrow at 10 o'clock at PabstTheaterGroup.com. I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy Max on What's on Tap. All right. Now admit it. As a kid, what was one of the books you always read? Did it have something to do with A Cat in the Hat or another Dr. Seuss character? Well, I think we all remember Dr. Seuss from our childhood. And coming up here in the next couple of days, Dr. Seuss is going to be right in Whitefish Bay, and we're going to hear about that in the next hour. Also, Matt Miller is going to join us, and he's going to give us his picks for all of the big blockbusters coming up this summer. It's all ahead on What's on Tap on WTMJ.
Your need-to-know cultural snapshot of Wisconsin and beyond. This is What's on Tap with Sandy Max, sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. A deep dive into all things intriguing, riveting, and entertaining. Now, here's your host, Sandy Max.
I'm Libby Collins in for Sandy until 8 o'clock tonight. She'll be back with you next week. And remember, What's on Tap is brought to you by Visit Milwaukee. Handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org. Well, let's all think back a while. Remember when you were young? What were some of the books that your mom or your dad or your grandparents read to you? I bet one of them might have been something like Cat in the Hat or another Dr. Seuss favorite. Well, he's just been a part of all of our childhoods and probably our children and our grandchildren as well. But you know what? It's not just his books. It's rare artwork. And coming to Whitefish Bay this weekend at Gallery 505 is The Art of Dr. Seuss. And I'm told this is a visually rich exhibition that features estate-authorized works that go far beyond the pages of those books that we all love. And in studio with us tonight is National Dr. Seuss Art Representative Jess Steiner. First of all, you literally just got off a plane.
I just drove in. It's a pleasure to be here, Libby. Yeah, I've flown in. What time zone am I in again?
It doesn't matter. We're talking about Dr. Seuss, and that's all in our imagination anyway.
That's right.
What attracted you first to Dr. Seuss? Do you remember how old you were when you first heard the name Dr. Seuss?
I mean, he's so much a fabric of American culture, and in my life, I grew up with him. There's no, you know, date I could place on it. It's just part of the popular imagination. I think the first time a Dr. Seuss book was read to me personally, it was One Fish, Two Fish, and it was because my parents couldn't get me in the bathtub. And that was the solution.
That I love that one. That's another one. I used to read that one to my son as well. Do you know offhand how many books were written?
He released about a book a year for many years.
We're talking
going.
About Ted Geisel.
That's right. Yeah. Ted Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss. But this was all from the imagination of one man. And, starting in the 30s, he started writing, kept going for decades until Oh, the Places You'll Go.
When he started writing those books, did he also create the art as he went along? How did that all come about?
His process was really interesting. And when you come see the exhibition, you're going to see some works that he did on commission when he was just getting started as an advertiser. So, and that discipline is highly informative when it comes to the way he went about writing a book. He would do the illustrations and the artwork along with the rhyming and the words and the layout itself. So you can see him in some of the pieces you'll see on the wall. You're going to see the way he's reworking it. So we have work in progress, what we call concept art, where you can see him toying around, crossing out words, rearranging compositions, because it's an active process. The words and the images go hand in hand.
So let's talk about Ted Geisel. Where did he come from? What was his background before he created Dr. Seuss?
He's got an amazing life story. Just like the Cat in the Hat, he kind of had nine lives. He comes from Western Massachusetts, and he was born into a family of brewers originally. His father worked at the alehouse, but Prohibition came along and forced his dad to become superintendent of the local park, which included the zoo. And that informs so much about his creativity, Ted's. He would go to sleep listening to the lion's roar and the elephant's trunks. That would become part of his dream life. And this is why he kind of saw animals as an extension of us.
And what was the first book he wrote?
The first book that was ever published by Dr. Seuss is To Think I Saw It on Mulberry Street.
And did that incorporate the animals? I don't recall that
book. It was
lots
of animals, lots of rhyming. It's a big tall tale by this boy who is coming home to tell his parents what he just saw on Main Street. Mulberry Street in Springfield, Massachusetts was just a few blocks away. What really made him hit early on as an author was Horton. That was his first iconic character.
Horton the Who.
Horton who hears the Who. He actually did a book predating that. It's kind of like the prequel to Horton Hears the Who called Horton Hatches the Egg. It came out right before he decided to become a political cartoonist. So he had written a few books, risen to some level of acclaim in advertising. Then he sees the threat coming from Europe, and he decides to put the children's books away, become a political cartoonist, and later joins the military in World War II.
I did not know he was a political cartoonist.
Oh, yeah, we'll have a few political cartoons.
Where was he published with those?
He was doing them freelance all over New York City at the time.
I mean, did the major newspapers pick them
up? They
did,
absolutely, yeah, because he was kind of a known quantity in the advertising world. And he did a number of great political cartoons, but he was cartooning in pen and ink, black and white, throughout his career.
Well, it is a fascinating exhibit. It's opening what day?
The grand opening is tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night. Okay.
At Gallery, just in time.
At Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay. We're going to tell you what some of the things you can see. And by the way, if you're watching us on YouTube or on our stream at WTMJ.com, you can see some of the artwork that's going to be displayed at Gallery 505. We've got that going along with our interview tonight with our guest, Jess Steiner, who is the National Dr. Seuss Art Representative. It's 7:14 and 58 degrees at WTMJ. Libby Collins in for Sandy. We are joined by Jess Steiner. He is a National Dr. Seuss Art Representative. Are you the only one, or are there others like you?
There are others.
There are others. But you certainly know about Ted Geisel and Dr. Seuss, and you're in town because there is a Art of Dr. Seuss exhibition that opens tomorrow night at Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay, and we're going to tell you more about that in just a moment. I want to return again, though, to Ted Geisel himself. When he was creating these characters, did he intend for those to be in a museum somewhere, or were they just illustrations that he was putting in his political cartoons or in his books, or was he also creating artwork?
He always thought of himself as an artist. He was sculpting out of snow when he was a little kid. So I don't think he considered himself an artist back then. But, you know, he went to Oxford University, and that led him to Europe, where he discovered the Surrealists in 1925. And I think he felt a little bit of a kinship with those artists, and he realized, okay, these doodles, these drawings, my creative instincts, this is legitimate art. And another influence that he had was Norman Rockwell. So the idea of a little bit of Americana and something that you can put not in a museum, but right on the cover of a magazine, as Norman Rockwell's paintings appeared, he was like, well, maybe children's book is the right place for art. He took it very seriously. He worked very diligently on the character design. He actually painted a number of his books every page, not just illustrating with pen and ink.
Before they were published in the books?
That's right. Now, we have not just those paintings, the real crucial aspect of this exhibition, which is called Discover the Art of Dr. Seuss. This is for the uninitiated and for the huge fan. You're not just seeing the art from the books. You're also seeing what he called his midnight paintings. So for years and years, he would work on the book all day. And if he couldn't get to sleep that night, or if he found himself, with a little bit of writer's block, He would turn to a canvas and start painting whatever was on his mind, experimenting with different artistic movements and techniques, and also revealing a lot about his interiority. So it's kind of when
you... So these are abstract works?
There are some abstractions, yes, but they're all different kinds. There's some abstract expressionism. There's some that are purely silly and fun, and there's some pretty revealing self-portraits.
Revealing in what way?
Well, when there's one in particular with a look of angst on his face, this character is grabbing his ears, looking up to the sky, and it is entitled Self-Portrait of the Artist Worrying About His Next Book. So it's kind of a part of the creative process. This is how he would navigate through his life. But he also painted, speaking about navigating through life, he had a wonderful view of the Pacific Ocean. He would paint a landscape. He wanted to just paint the waves. But he added always a character to make things accessible to the viewer, so they could put themselves in the work, perhaps, or he was putting himself in the work. So on these landscapes or seascapes, suddenly he would add a bird. In one case, the piece I'm thinking of is called Firebird, where there's this tremendous wave and this bird is gracefully navigating over it. In a way, he's kind of saying to us, you know, navigate life with grace and ease.
Did he talk about these things at all?
He kept these things very private. These paintings were a personal project, things that he didn't really want to be shown to the world while he was around. So he told his wife, after I'm gone, then you can make these sorts of exhibitions possible. He was a shy person.
How many of those sort of works were there? Do you have any idea?
You know, I keep hearing different numbers. We originally thought that there were, you know, somewhere in the 60 to 70 range that originally discovered. But the archive, we keep discovering new works. There are studies we had never heard of. In fact, a manuscript of an upcoming book by Dr. Seuss that has not yet been released was discovered in 2025, due to be released June 2nd.
Where were these things?
All in his home. He was private. Oh. He kept them. It's a great story.
Yeah.
He kept all of these things, or most of them, hidden behind a closet, like in Clue or something. You would see a hidden library, a hidden door.
Yeah.
So if you pulled the Cat in the Hat translated into Russian, it would open up this bookshelf, and behind it, there was a treasure trove.
We are talking with Jess Steiner. He is a Dr. Seuss art representative, and he is in town because Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay is having the Art of Dr. Seuss exhibition that opens tomorrow night. We're going to tell you more about that and exactly what you will see there. What a fascinating man Ted Geisel was. It's 722 on WTMJ. Sandy will be back next week. I'm Libby Collins until 8 tonight, along with the representative for Dr. Seuss Art. It's an exhibition that's taking place in Whitefish Bay this week. And we've got Jess Steiner here. All right, let's talk about the exhibition itself. How many works will you be displaying?
Well, I just stopped by and they are up now. It's about 40 works, maybe a few more. And they're up now for acquisition. So all of these pieces are framed, beautifully arranged. We have our opening night tomorrow, but this exhibition runs through the month. Tomorrow and Saturday are really the time to come if you can make it. But you will be able to see these works. We're kind of doubling what they normally would put on the wall with this exhibition. And it runs the gamut through his entire life. We were talking about his advertising career. So this goes from the 30s all the way to the end of the 80s.
What products did he use to represent as an advertising?
You know, one of his first advertising coups was a thing called Flit bug spray. And the innovation that he provided was making advertising funny. He brought a sense of humor to it. And back then in the 30s, if you can imagine, it was just a simple slogan, or, you know, you say what the price is of your product, you know, give a thumbs up. He took it a little farther, added something a little more subversive, and that became his brand.
And will you have that artwork?
We have some amazing pieces from around that period of time. The artwork itself is, I think, a lot more beautiful than the ads for Flit. We have these amazing Art Deco style pieces that he painted on wood panels that tell amazingly intricate stories, but he did them on commission, did them sometimes for advertising and sometimes for calendar companies that would commit, you know, we need 12 months of imagery, right? Before iCal and everything was on your phone, you wanted a calendar up, and his imagery is so signature, puts a smile on your face. We have a couple of those on
you,
display.
You mentioned that his imagery has a special signature to it. When you just look at a piece, can you tell it was created by Ted Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss?
Dr. Seuss, as you said, a.k.a. Ted Geisel, he tries to hide it. He tries to imitate. You know, you'll see a Jackson Pollock-style painting if you come to the exhibition, but he can't help himself with adding his own distinct fingerprint. He always puts in something that is unmistakably Seuss. And what do I mean by that? That is a combination of things. One of his signatures is the anthropomorphization of animals, making them human, making them us. The other thing is this precarious balance, this crazy asymmetry. If you think about any of the Cat in the Hat balancing the umbrella or anything like that, it's always this precarious balance. His life is a balancing act, and he kind of returned to that as a motif visually many, many times. The other thing you're going to notice is this surrealism, this sort of Salvador Dali-esque architecture that runs through works from, as I said, from the 30s through the late 80s.
What do you think he wanted to be known for most?
Wow. I cannot read his mind. What did he want to be known for? That's a great question. I think that he wanted to provide universal truths to the most people with the brains like a sponge. I think that he also kind of wanted to Trojan horse some of these messages to the people reading the books. A lot of his books were prescient, were about global conflict, like the Cold War, and they were just as much for the kids as the parents.
I want to find out if some of his books had his views of the world in them. And I hold that thought, Jess. I'm going to give you a couple minutes to think about it. We are talking with Jess Steiner. He is a national Dr. Seuss art representative who is in town because Studio or Gallery 505 in Whitefish Bay is opening a special Dr. Seuss art exhibit tomorrow night. We'll have more about that in just a couple minutes. But before we do anything else, let's go to the WTMJ Breaking News Center with Jessica Gatzo. Jess? I'm Libby Collins, and for Sandy Max tonight, we're joined by Jess Steiner. He's a national Dr. Seuss art representative who has brought the art of Dr. Seuss to Gallery 505. It opens tomorrow night in Whitefish Bay. All right, you kind of indicated that Ted Geisel, who created Dr. Seuss, had a pretty strong view of the world politically and I'm so sure socially. Does any of that, his views of the world, show up in any of his art, either for the children, other than what he did in the political vein?
Oh, he was much more socially minded than politically. It's really about putting a smile on people's face. When you ask that question about what did he want to leave a mark on, over and over, the thing that's pervasive in all of his work is whimsy and having fun and having a sense of humor. It's, you know, just something that the world lacks that he was able to inject into every subject matter he touched, every book. He makes kids laugh. He makes them want to learn to read. This was another lifelong passion. He got, once he started writing these books, he started hearing about kids learning to read through them. He got kind of hooked on that feeling. Later creating the Seuss Foundation, which is something that is all about literacy. So he teaching so many children how to read, giving them a lifelong love of learning, that, and with a smile on your face doing it, that was his dream.
I want to find out about some of the art that you have. We talked about the paintings and things like that, but there's something also that's going to be at the gallery called Unorthodox Taxidermy?
Yeah, did you know that Dr. Seuss was a sculptor before he ever wrote a children's book?
I think you mentioned it, but it didn't really hit me.
Not many people know, and I want people to come into the gallery and discover what these pieces look like. Basically, he took parts of animals and his own imagination and reincarnated these zoo creatures, putting smiles on their faces to last forever. He said, I want to bring these back as the creatures they want to be forever.
Give us an example. What are some of these unorthodox taxidermy pieces?
One incredible one you're going to see if you walk in right at the entrance, there's a piece that utilizes ram's horns, but is actually a creature that swims, and it's called the Goo-Goo-Eyed Tasmanian Woolghast.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. I will say no more about the way it looks. You have to see it for yourself.
So you've got a number of these pieces at the gallery.
We have about seven. And there's an entire menagerie.
I think a lot of people are wondering, are these all original? What exactly are we going to see at the exhibit?
What you're going to see is the exclusive and only way to collect the art of Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss, he wanted to make sure that his originals were protected and not taken into one private collection, taken from view. So this is accessible to everyone, just like his books. You can come in and acquire a piece for yourself. These are limited edition, and they're estate authorized. So you do get a posthumous signature from Dr. Seuss in a certificate of authenticity.
Are these numbered?
These are all numbered and all, as I said, estate authorized.
And they're all for sale, everything that's going to be at the gallery?
Everything you see can be acquired, absolutely.
All right, we are here with Jess Steiner. We're going to tell you one last time where this is all going on, and it's not just tomorrow. It's going to be a month-long exhibit. It's all coming up on What's on Tap on WTMJ.
I hereby bequeath the Cara Dining Table from Penny Mustard to my great-great...
I'm Libby Collins, and we've been talking about Dr. Seuss with Jess Steiner and about the art exhibit that is going to be in Whitefish Bay. Now, this is the only authorized Dr. Seuss place in all of Wisconsin?
In all of Wisconsin right now, the only place that you can acquire these from an authorized gallery is Gallery 505. So it's got a real special place for this state and the Milwaukee area, of course. If you haven't heard of it, you haven't stopped by before, they're an amazing team, and they're putting on Discover the Art of Dr. Seuss right now to kind of introduce you to the collection.
And lots of pieces, 40, 50,
40
how many?
Some odd pieces. So it really, and these are all different shapes and sizes, like we were just talking about, the sculptures that range wildly, but also small illustrations to huge illustrations to big canvas paintings.
Now, I assume you can just come in at any time. You don't need a reservation to see the art?
No, you don't need a reservation, but if you can make it tomorrow around 6 p.m., 7 p.m. for opening night, I will be there. I'd love to shake your hand and say hello. I'll also be around for a bit of an open house on Saturday if you can't make it to the special event on Friday. Then it's, you know, going for the rest of June, nearly till the end of the month.
Will there be green eggs and ham at the reception?
There will be green eggs and ham on the wall for sure.
Jess, it's delightful that you're here. Thank you so much for stopping by. And again, it's the Art of Dr. Seuss at Gallery 505. Starts tomorrow night through Tuesday, June 30th.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Libby.
Jess Steiner, thank you again for being here. It is 7:44, and this is your shot to get the best golf outing of the season. WTMJ is sending you and three friends to the WTMJ Classic Golf Outing presented by Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. It's June 30th at Morningstar Golfers Club in Waukesha. A foursome. On us. Just head to WTMJ.com and get entered right now. You've got through Friday, June 1st. Step up, take your swing, and we'll see you on the course. It's summer blockbuster movie season, and I can't think of anybody I'd rather talk to about what's going to be in those Cineplexes than Matt Miller. And Matt, before we do anything else, congratulations, because now we can call you Daddy.
I know, just in time for Father's Day.
Our most sincere congratulations to you, but let's talk movies, because this is the season, and here on Friday, The Mandalorian opened. It means Star Wars is back in the theaters again.
Yeah, it kind of. It's a weird one, right? Because it's a new Star Wars movie in theaters, and I think we remember, you know, when The Force Awakens came out and even Rise of Skywalker, those Star Wars movies felt like such events, and this one kind of feels like it's just kind of ambling into theaters. I'll be interested to see what its box office looks like this weekend, because there just doesn't seem to be that much excitement for it, and I don't know if part of that is because they've done a pretty bad job of kind of showing why this story needs to make the jump to the big screen. I also wonder, maybe the time for The Mandalorian has passed, you know? People really liked that 5-6 years ago, especially at the start of the pandemic. You know, those first few seasons were really fun, but those latter seasons got really stuck into kind of fan service and expanded universe stuff with the Star Wars other miniseries, and I think it kind of lost a little bit of its luster. So we'll see how it performs this weekend. Obviously, it's a Star Wars movie, so expectations are high, but it just doesn't seem like the excitement is there for a new Star Wars movie, which is just such a strange thing to say.
What are you really excited about seeing this summer?
Yeah, I think it's a big summer for directors. And in general, we have seen kind of audiences really attract themselves to interesting directors over, say, stars or even concepts and stuff like that. What people really are interested in is directors who have vision. So I'm obviously really excited about the new Christopher Nolan movie, him returning after winning Best Picture and like 20 other Oscars for Oppenheimer. He's coming back with The Odyssey. Obviously, everyone knows the story of The Odyssey. It looks very epic. It looks really exciting. Anyone who's ever been good at acting is basically in that movie. Really excited for that coming out on July 17th. Also, he filmed, I think, the entire movie on IMAX. So that's a movie that's going to feel big. That's a movie that's going to feel massive. So really excited for that. And I'm also really excited, Steven Spielberg. I don't know if you heard of him. He's got a new movie coming out this year, and he's going back to UFOs. It's weird to think that it's been a long time since the guy who kind of entered so many important chapters to the sci-fi genre with, you know, Close Encounters and E.T. and many others along the way. He's returning to UFOs with Disclosure Day, starring Josh O'Connor, who was terrific in the latest Knives Out movie, and Emily Blunt as people trying to figure out some alien conspiracy. Sounds really fun. I believe Steven Spielberg also wrote the story for this. The story is a Steven Spielberg idea, which he doesn't do very often. Normally, Spielberg is just a director. He's not a writer-director. So I'm really interested to see that as well, because, I mean, I don't want to be, morbid here, but I don't know how many more Steven Spielberg movies we have left, especially at this size and scale and blockbuster scope. So I'm really excited to check that out on June 12th.
I am too. I've seen the promos for it, and it's intriguing.
Yes, I think that's the right word for it. Like, Steven Spielberg doesn't make, you know, the kind of movies that, like, make great trailers right now. You know, he's an older guy, and the thrills in his movies are much more calibrated, and I do think they're holding a lot back in the trailers, too. I think they're really trying to kind of mystery box this, because you've got, a UFO story. I think you want to entice people with the idea of, like, what are we all going to be doing with UFOs and aliens in this movie? So it makes a lot of sense that they're kind of keeping a lot to the vest, and I think that's going to be the case with Disclosure Day up until the end.
We are talking with one of my favorite film critics, Matt Miller, about the blockbusters that we have to look forward to this summer. And now that you're a dad, I bet you can't wait to see the new Toy Story movie.
It's funny because, you know, Toy Story is one of my favorite movie franchises. I mean, Toy Story 3 absolutely wrecked me back in the day. Even if the worst movie in the franchise is Toy Story 4, which is still a really good movie, like, you're doing really well. And I think it's interesting how the Toy Story movies have grown up with the kids that started with the Toy Story franchise. You know, when we were kids, it was about the toys, just kind of being toys. Toy Story 3, when we were going to college, so was Andy. So we're kind of the toys having to deal with that. And now in this fifth one, we're all parents now. And Toy Story 5 is about, you know, tablets and the new generation of kids. And what are they playing with? So I'm really excited to see that not only as a Toy Story fan, but as a new Toy Story father.
Oh, well, we can't wait to see it either. Anything else that you really say is don't miss it this summer?
I'm really excited to see comedies back on the big screen this summer. Comedies really took a lot of time off this ever since the pandemic, and even before the pandemic. We've done a good job of telling audiences that comedies are not worth the big screen, and that does seem to be changing a little bit. So I'm loving to see that, you know, there's a new scary movie coming out this summer. And do I think it's going to be a Best Picture nominee? Absolutely not. But it's nice to see a comedy given the big screen treatment again. Same with something like Jackass Best and Last. You know, it's really nice to see.
Are they really bringing that back?
They are. It seems like they're doing one more. And I got to say, those movies are so much fun. Oh. And there's something kind of almost weirdly sweet about them. Like, they are obviously like gross and childish, but there is something sweet about this like relationship between all these men that has now reached the point where they're like in their 50s and 60s now. You know, I don't know if they're that old per se, but you know, look at Johnny Knoxville's hair, and that is hair that has seen some things, that color. So it's nice to see, you know, a comedy back on the big screen again. And so I'm really excited that there's even an original comedy coming out near the end of summer called One Night Only, which is from the director of Anyone But You, the Glenn Powell, Sidney Sweeney movie that became a surprise Christmas hit a few years ago. There's a new rom-com from him coming out at the end of summer. So that's really exciting for me. People have asked, you know, is the box office back? And for the first time since the pandemic, this kind of feels like the box office is back. Not only because the numbers are good right now, but because the movies that are doing well, it's a variety of movies. It's not just Marvel movies and big franchise movies that are holding up the box office. It's smaller movies. It's comedies. It's movies for adults. It's horror movies. It's all sorts of stuff. It's original movies. And that is the sign of a healthy ecosystem where a Minions movie can do really well, but so can original sci-fi. So can a rom-com. And I think that is where we want to be again, where there's something for everybody in theaters again, because then you're going to get everybody back to theaters again. And for a long time, we didn't have something for everybody.
Matt, it is so great that you took the time out to join us today to talk about movies once again. And you're still writing about them.
I am. They might have more typos and they might sound a little bit more sleep deprived than usual, but I am writing things at a man about film on Substack.
Well, we will check that out as well. Thanks again. Get some sleep, because I can tell in your voice you are tired dad right now.
I don't know what you're talking about. I think I sound totally well slept.
Matt Miller, have a great day. Thank you again.
You too. Thanks for having me.
I think Matt needs some of those Dr. Seuss books. I mean, you can never have too many of them if you've got a little one in the house. And it's never too early to start reading to your kids. Even if they don't understand what you're saying, it's just that comfort knowing mom or dad are close by and they're sharing some time with you. So speaking of sharing with time, thanks for sharing some time with me today and tomorrow, or today and yesterday. We had a great time here on What's on Tap, Sandy Max. We'll be back from vacation next week. And boy, you know, she wanted me to once again remind you that she is the co-host of the Skylight Theater's Tony Awards Watch Party on Sunday, June 7th. She's going to tell you all about it and how you can be part of it when she returns next week to What's on Tap. Remember, What's on Tap is sponsored by Visit Milwaukee. Handcrafted, homegrown, world-class. Discover more at visitmilwaukee.org. I'm Libby Collins. Thank you so much for joining us today. And stick around, because right after the news with Jessica Gatso, it's Brewers Weekly with Dom Cotroneo right here on WTMJ. Have a great evening, everyone.